Climate change is here. AI is here. By consequence of COVID, we had a huge shift towards remote working. We are heavily dependent on multinational corporations for employment.
In the aftermath of this trade war that has been launched by the United States, there might be new questions. Hello, this is FEPS Talks, the podcast series of the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. My name is Laszlo Andor, I'm the Secretary General of FEPS, and I have the great pleasure today to welcome Michelle O'Sullivan at FEPS, who is an Associate Professor at the Department of Work and Employment Studies at the University of Limerick. And in Ireland, she plays a leading role on industrial relations, chairing the Irish Association for Industrial Relations, but also being a member of the Editorial Advisory Board of the Journal of Industrial Relations. And very importantly for FEPS, she's also a member of the Board of Directors of TASC, which is a member organization for FEPS. Welcome in Brussels.
Thank you, Laszlo.
So thank you so much for joining us. I would need to start with a question of a little bit of anxiety. There is a lot of anxiety in Brussels, especially for the stakeholders of Social Europe, because there is a feeling in the air that the achievements of the past period might be at risk. We believe that in the previous mandate, when Nicolas Schmit was the commissioner, so much happened in a positive direction. So many positive responses were given, the COVID-19 crisis, flexibility work in favor of the employees, and job-saving schemes were rolled out, income stabilization was taking place in many European countries when the crisis hit, minimum wage coordination, a big achievement at the European Union level, and now many of these are put at risk, either by employers, either by national governments, either by courts. So there is seemingly a period when there is at least uncertainty, maybe even anxiety about the continuation. How do you see?
Yes, you're definitely correct in noting that the last couple of years have seen quite a lot of advances for workers' rights, both by consequence of COVID. We had a huge shift towards remote working. I mean, there's still only approximately a third of employees in Europe who have teleworkable jobs, according to Eurofound research agency. But of those workers, quite a significant proportion did move online. Some countries much more than others. The Netherlands and Ireland had quite significant high rates of remote working compared to other countries, such as in Eastern Europe. The latest research from Eurofound shows that there has been some retraction that in terms of the type of remote working. So those people who were fully remote, they are lesser in number. So they are reducing in terms of the number of people who are fully remote. But there's still quite a significant proportion of people in teleworkable jobs who are working hybrid, roughly close to half. So there has been some shift towards away from fully remote to hybrid. So there's still quite a lot of advantages for workers in terms of hybrid working. It may be that some of that continuation of hybrid working has been driven by labour shortages. Certainly in Ireland, employers would say they would find it very difficult to attract workers without offering hybrid working. And research does tend to show that people see it as a high priority when moving jobs, even to the extent that they might be willing to reduce their incomes. So there's definitely significant advantages. We know that during the pandemic period, there was also some disadvantages, particularly for women, in terms of increased workload intensity and somewhat of an always on culture. So some of those issues still have to be worked out. There are some challenges. For example, last year we did a study for an Irish agency on how employers and workers are dealing with the challenges of remote and hybrid working. Some of the challenges are that managers still lack skills in managing people online, in terms of inductions, performance management, and so on. And there can also be tensions between workers and employers about what is meant by hybrid working. Mm-hmm. So many workers would prefer to work at least a few days a week online, whereas employers would prefer more of that time to be in the office. And that can be a challenge. And there's wide variation in terms of the extent to which companies want policies in this area. To some extent, what we found is that employers are afraid to formalize arrangements in policies around hybrid and remote working because things may change and the labor market may change. And they don't necessarily want to institutionalize commitments to hybrid working that may change in the future. So, of course, if the labour market changes significantly in terms of labour shortages, those advantages that workers may have had may be rescinded even further. You also noted the national and EU level issues. And of course, there has been major advances in legislation in the last couple of years, particularly around things like increased flexibility for carers and parents. There has been some concern of a work-life balance privilege gap. That is that people who are working more online have more opportunities for flexibility in the work compared to people who do not work online, and that there may be a growing somewhat of an inequality, a qualitative inequality between people who can work online who can't because of those links to greater flexibility. So that is somewhat of a concern. At the EU level, we've seen, for example, of course, a major development was the EU minimum wages directive.
Yes.
And there was great hope, particularly for trade unions, with regard to both the criteria attached to minimum wages, but in particular, great hope in terms of the collective bargaining measures, particularly for those countries where trade union density is quite low. And trade union density has been falling in many countries globally. There are significant challenges with that. The recent Advocate General's decision that the directive should be annulled has caused quite a significant concern, as you can imagine, for unions. There's also been a lot of criticism of that decision by legal experts about the approach of the Advocate General in the legal reasoning for it. So there is hope that that decision, that opinion will not be supported by the European Court of Justice, in particular because the issue of the EU's interference in pay setting, and that was the basis for the Advocate General's decision, that many people say that there's a contradiction there, because during the global financial crisis, we had significant intervention, but at the EU level, in national pay setting and support for rescinding collective bargaining arrangements, reducing minimum wages, particularly in countries like Ireland and Greece. So there, in a sense, the legal experts are saying we have precedence there in terms of the EU's intervention in wages. I think apart from the Advocate General's decision, there is also some concern about national governments' implementation of the directive, particularly with regard to collective bargaining, because the governments have to introduce action plans by the end of this year about how the collective bargaining elements are going to be implemented by governments. But to date, there has been some concern by trade unions at the EU level that some of the approaches by the national governments have been of a minimalist nature. And some governments have decided that no new legislation is needed to implement the directive. For example, Ireland, which is a country with constantly reducing trade union density and lowering collective bargaining coverage. And there is a concern that the action plans will not be strong enough, that there is not enough teeth to the directive to push forward the objective of enhancing collective bargaining. So there's concerns at multiple levels, but I think the primary concern is really at the national government level rather than at the EU level, if the hope is that the Court of Justice will not support the Advocate General's decision.
Indeed. You pointed to the Irish experience in your presentation. I wonder if we could put this into a historic perspective, because in my view, we need to go back to the Great Financial Crisis, when Ireland really suffered a setback that probably ended this long period of the Celtic Tiger, high growth, strong economy experience with a lot of good development, by the way. And at the same time, it was really a shock. not only the collapse of the financial system, but of the, also the impact on real estate and the housing crisis, really triggering a disruption of the social dialogue. Emigration from the country again, when Ireland previously became a country of immigration because there was so much labor demand in the economy. So how do you see the legacy of this shock? And has Ireland recovered in terms of the industrial relations from this shock experience?
In terms of industrial relations, I would say it hasn't. Our social dialogue in Ireland is comparatively weak. We had, before the global financial crisis, there was a system of social partnership with social pacts with unions and employers engaging in economic and social policy decision making together, and in particular, wage setting for unionized workers. And that system no longer exists except in the public sector. So in just, there has been quite a significant split in industrial relations between the public and private sector. The public sector is still primarily governed by collective bargaining, where unions are still strong. And pay setting has been very formal and has been stabilized. The wage setting process has been very stable in terms of unions' involvement with the employers in the public sector. In the private sector, there's been a return to decentralized bargaining. And there has been no appetite by either unions or employers to return to a national level pay setting arrangements. But there has been an appetite for greater social dialogue. And unions and employer bodies all argue that we need better social dialogue. More, they talk about more European style social dialogue, but not including pay setting.
So what would that cover in this case?
They talk about the challenges that we have in terms of national issues like infrastructure, childcare, in particular is a major issue, housing. So these national level issues where also the government and employers in particular feel that they should not bear the cost for infrastructural issues. So wage claims have in particular have been driven by both cost of living issues and in particular by housing issues. But employers feel that they should not bear the burden of infrastructural challenges, and they seek greater dialogue with government to deal with those issues. The issue is that we have quite weak social dialogue forums. We have a national economic labor forum where employers and unions do engage with each other in dialogue, but these tend to be issues such as childcare. There tend to be some reports, but hard measures are not often the output of the forum. And there's major issues which are not covered by social dialogue. For example, last year we did a study on how social actors, how the social partners are dealing with major polycrisis issues. And for example, climate change is not one of the issues which is currently examined under the Labour Economic Forum. Indeed, you know, our research shows that the social partners have not engaged to any significant degree in climate change issues. And more immediate issues like the cost of living have been their primary concern, and wage claims. So that is a major issue, I think. And it's not, Ireland is not necessarily unique. I mean, research globally shows that, you know, employers and unions generally have not paid sufficient attention to climate change. There was a study a number of years ago by the International Labour Organization, which showed that in their analysis of collective agreements globally, roughly only about a quarter had mentioned environmental issues. And even in places in like in Australia, where you could think that climate change issues would be more to the fore in negotiations because of their history of things like temperatures, that even in collective agreements where they do mention climate change, they're often very weak. So I think it's a challenge for unions and employer organizations globally. We also see in research across Europe that on occasions you can have very good union employer agreements which try to implement the principles of trust transition. And on the other hand, you have issues, case studies where you show that employers and unions work together to prohibit the development of environmental issues because they see an environment-labor trade-off. And they're concerned that the more environmental issues and more environmental measures are taken, the greater the cost to competitiveness and to employment. So we can see coalitions sometimes of national or local governmental bodies and unions and employers protecting competitiveness and employment issues to the detriment of environmental issues. So I think this is a global challenge for unions and employers to not see that trade-off between climate and labour, and also to implement the principles of just transition, which are at the moment quite principled. But when you talk to employers and unions, sometimes they say, we don't know what that looks like in practice.
Yes. I think some might be kind of hesitant to use this expression, just transition. But I think if you translate it to the everyday functioning of the economy, I think it's quite straightforward. That's a direction we would need to go to. I was wondering if there is a discussion among social partners in Ireland about the overall growth model, because Ireland has a very unique growth model based on a specific approach to taxation and multinational companies. And maybe in the aftermath of this trade war that has been launched by the United States, there might be new questions around it.
Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely. We have a very unique growth model. We are heavily dependent on multinational corporations for employment. A significant proportion of our employment is either directly or indirectly linked to our multinational companies. We have most of the major financial services companies are located in Ireland. We have most of the major technology companies are located in Ireland and have big numbers of employees. In even my own city in Cork, we have thousands of employees employed just in Apple. So it is a major issue. The difficulty is that there hasn't been much conversation about the growth model, except, for example, by employer organizations who represent small businesses. They don't question the direction of dependency on multinational companies, but they question the lack of investment by government in small business. The major difficulty for employers and unions and government to question the growth model is because of our heavy dependency, it's extremely difficult to remove ourselves from that path. We're path dependent now on multinational companies. A small proportion of those multinational companies, even four multinational companies, account for a significant proportion of our corporation tax rates. So our income is heavily dependent on them. Now, we've had huge surpluses in our tax in recent years, driven by the multinational companies. We would hope that the government would use it wisely in terms of not using it on day-to-day spending, but the pressures on government are huge. We, as comparatively, the Irish government spends a lower proportion of its GDP on infrastructure than other small, high-income countries in Europe. So we've major challenges in terms of infrastructure, water, housing, electricity. And because we have a significant proportion of technology data centres in Ireland, there is big questions about that in particular because of their huge consumption of electricity. But overall, there is little explicit questioning of the growth model because so many jobs are dependent on it. And now that it's a major risk factor for the country if we lose those multinationals.
I see the point. Where I'm sure there is a big debate about the growth model is the island between Ireland and the European Union, which is Great Britain. And I wanted to ask your opinion about the British developments, because in the last 6 months since the new government really entered office, there is an explicit endeavor to improve industrial relations. And already in the election time, but also afterwards, they came forward with specific proposals to improve the conditions of the employees, to deal with 0-hour contracts, and many other items. Do you see a big change, a turnaround with employment relations in the United Kingdom in the aftermath? Where is it going to? Is it going to serve with some good examples, good practices for the rest of us?
Certainly, there has been a major shift in the approach of government to workers' rights. And the government has produced an employment rights bill in the UK with a whole host of measures Under the previous governments in the UK, there had been very much a retraction of workers' rights, including, for example, the UK has one of the most restrictive laws in the developed world on strikes and had introduced more restrictive laws in the last 10 years or so. So there has been commitments made by the new Labour government to retract some of those laws. Workers' representatives would say they don't go far enough. That there's proposals to retract some strike laws that were introduced in the last number of years, but not some of the restrictive strike laws that were introduced in the 80s and 90s. There have been many proposals to introduce workers' rights with regard to, for example, sick leave, 0 hours work, unfair dismissals. And that has been very much welcomed. Again, workers' representatives would say they welcome it, but don't go far enough. Mm-hmm. And that there are still too many restrictions. At the moment, some of those employment rights proposals have not been fleshed out and some of the detail has not been presented exactly. They're going through a consultation period at the moment, so we wait for more detail. I suppose one of the particular concerns there would be, and this is a concern which is not unique to the UK, but to most countries in the world, is the issue of employment status. Mm-hmm. And who is a worker, who is an employee, who is a self-employed person. And that's a major challenge for legal systems internationally. And we've seen that has been the basis for major disputes in many European countries with regard to gig economy workers like Deliveroo and Uber and outside Uber as well. And there'll be many strikes and legal cases on that issue. And that is an ongoing challenge. And the UK government has not clarified that enough. There are some, for example, rights proposed in their new employment rights bills, which will only apply to employees, such as unfair dismissals. And there are other rights under the employment rights bill, which will only apply to workers. So that is going to be an ongoing challenge for the legal system in the UK when you have a differentiation of rights between workers and employees. Mm-hmm. And of course, the UK has that third category of workers that some other legal systems don't have. There's only a few legal systems in Europe that have this third worker category in between employee and self-employed. Mm. So this is an ongoing challenge, I think, at the EU level about the employment status of workers. We saw that there was some legislative developments at the EU level with regard to the Platform Workers Directive to try and cover this grey area that platform workers or gig workers occupy between employee and self-employed. And of course, many of them are, it was arguable, are bogusly self-employed and should be categorised as employees. So that's a major challenge, I think, and will be an ongoing one at the national and EU level. That's not going away anytime soon. Gig economy work still remains quite small, but if it expands to a greater degree, we have approximately in Europe about 3/4 of people who are on so-called permanent contracts, but that could be, you could have somebody on a permanent 0 hours arrangement. So that's not necessarily a total guarantee. Permanency is not a total guarantee of good employment rights. So the UK has definitely made some improvements. It's playing a lot of catch up, in fact, with what's already been standard in many EU countries. You would imagine that there will be a lot of employer resistance to it. I suppose, unfortunately, for the Labour government, because of the economic situation in the UK and the budgetary deficits that they have, it presents an ongoing challenge, I think, in implementing workers' rights, because it will fortify employers' opposition to improvement in workers' rights when you also have these other challenges in terms of budget. And the UK has increased things like, you know, employers' social insurance, and there'll be minimum wage increases. So how those things play out with the development of workers' rights will be an important issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brexit certainly didn't make it easier for them to deal with all these issues. But if I understand correctly, on some issues, the British government needs to be revolutionary in order to just to catch up with the continental standards. Mm-hmm. But there are other issues where we are facing the same questions. Mm-hmm. And then maybe collectively we could solve the problems through legislation or otherwise more easily. But maybe we could move on to, let's say, issues of the future. Because I think it's very important not to see the whole question of social standards as a defensive one. that there are many, many threats and we are defending the status quo. But there are also sometimes new ideas that provide some opportunity, offer some opportunity for further improvements, like there are many discussions, sometimes even tests, of the four-day work week. Mm-hmm. And this seems to be sometimes a big innovation, which is interesting for workers, but also corporations or also municipalities sometimes, in as much as you know, the effect on the positive effect on urban transport and other aspects. How do you see this or other ideas which are discussed and tested occasionally?
Mm. And I think it's related to the discussion we had earlier about flexibility for workers. And certainly that, you know, the issue of working hours and number of working hours has been an issue for 150 years. And often the concern, the immediate reaction against the 4-day working week is that for those who are against it, is that it must create a reduction in productivity. But we know that the richest countries in the world are also the ones which have had, you know, the greatest reductions in working hours historically. Mm. So it's too simple to say that a reduction in working week will lead to a reduction in productivity. The scientific evidence so far on the 4-day working week is very inconclusive. Mm-hmm. Many of the people who of the advocates of the 4-day week are often trade unions or policy advocates or think tanks who highlight the benefits. And there tends to be a lot of media attention on certain case studies of the 4-day working week. There was a lot of media attention, for example, on a case in New Zealand where a financial services company implemented a 4-day working week, and that received quite a lot of global attention. And it apparently had produced, you know, great benefits in terms of particularly like productivity. The issue about the 4-day working week is that there's still a lot to be worked out. There are very much potential advantages in terms of the flexibility for workers without a detrimental impact on productivity. There are questions about how it should be introduced. So are we talking about a 4-day week with a reduction in working hours, or are we talking about a compressed week where a 4-day week is not accompanied by a reduction in working hours? And that can have a big implication in terms of its advantages. But at the moment, the conclusion from researchers in academia is that it's inconclusive. Some of the evidence points to particular benefits that I've already mentioned, like flexibility, less stress for workers. Other evidence points to stress depending on how it's implemented. So that example I gave of the financial services company in New Zealand, that was driven by management in that company rather than the workers. And researchers in that case found that it had been accompanied by quite strict managerialist approach, with much heavier monitoring of workers, much heavier monitoring of performance. And in that particular case, the 4-day working week was only allowed to continue if individual workers were producing enough. Even things like, you know, things that became what were normal habits to workers, like having coffee to workers, was interpreted as being, for example, workers were not producing enough. So we have to be careful about how it's introduced, about the methods by which performance is evaluated. But there are certainly opportunities there. Mm-hmm. And I think unions would very much welcome it if it's implemented in a way in which workers are deeply involved in its design and in its implementation.
Mm-hmm. So what method, what approach would be better in your view? To go for one big idea and identify one big goal, one big instrument, potentially a silver bullet, which would solve many questions, or to spread out the agenda and look for incremental improvements in different fields, in different parts of the spectrum of the social agenda and industrial relations?
Well, I think, you know, a one size fits all in terms of principles, I think is quite all right. You know, if we have a basic set of principles about what the advantages of the 4-day week may be, whether it's worker flexibility, whether it's to allow other people into the labour market, which has often been the reason why reduced working hours have appeared in the first place. I mean, reduced working hours have often appeared on the policy agendas when there has been a crisis economically and when it's been seen as a way of trying to get more people into the labour market. So I think the principle setting is a fine at a global or a macro level. But I think it would be a mistake to impose certain types or formulas for a 4-day week on workplaces. And I think these are things that can be customized to the individual sectors or to workplaces. And I think somewhat like the right to disconnect, that the most appropriate ways of introducing it are to say, well, the responsibility is on unions and employer bodies and employers to work out the arrangements that best suit their needs. And I think the important issue here is not to lose sight of what the 4-day week symbolizes, which is flexibility. And flexibility can come in many shapes and forms. So, for example, there's been very helpful statistical information from the UK about their flexible practices. And we've seen in recent years in the UK a rise in annualized hours arrangements, which are not very common. But mm-hmm. there's huge advantages to annualized hours arrangements, particularly in sectors and workplaces where you have wide variation in demand and where working hours may peak and trough in different periods of the year. So you have, it offers security for workers in terms of working hours. It offers stability in terms of pay, but it also offers flexibility for employers when they do need to adjust labor to demand. So I think there's, if you like, many ways to skin a cat. And the 4-day week is just one example of that. But there are many other examples of flexibility which could be part of the toolkit for workers and employers. So I think at a macro level, at a policy level, all these different types of flexibility should be offered or should be advocated for, but mm-hmm. but to allow unions and employer bodies to customize whichever one fits best to their needs.
I think this is a wonderful conclusion of our conversation today. I'm really grateful for your analysis and advice on all these questions. And I think it signals that when we face so many challenges, climate challenge, security challenge, it should all be an incentive to look for better solutions at the workplace and look for opportunities to improve the social standards.
Absolutely. And we have major challenges coming. Climate change is here, but has not been given the attention I think it deserves. AI is here. And it has received quite a lot of attention. So these are major issues. But as you say, there are solutions to these things. It just requires cooperation and the encouragement that cooperation with unions is a benefit, not a disincentive to change.
Thank you very much. And I believe we will have opportunities to continue this conversation.
Thank you, Leslie.